supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A member of a long-time Philadelphia political dynasty, Rene Tartaglione, was sentenced today to spend nearly 7 years in federal prison. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the sentence comes after a jury convicted Tartaglione on more than 50 counts, including theft and fraud, for stealing $2 million from a mental health clinic in North Philadelphia.
Rene Tartaglione is from a well-connected family. Her mother used to oversee city elections. Her sister is a state senator. And she herself, for 25 years, served in the city commissioner's office. But now Tartaglione, who is 62 years old, will be going to prison for 6 years and 10 months and have to pay more than $2 million for her role in an embezzlement scheme. Assistant U.S. Attorney B. Witzleben prosecuted the case.
She really lined her own pockets with the clinic's money while she had a very significant conflict of interest.
That conflict? Tartaglione was both the landlord of the clinic's buildings and the president of the board of directors, so she approved paying much higher rents, then stole the money. The
clinic went from paying $4,500 a month to paying $25,000 a month for the same building.
After the hearing, Tartaglione's husband, Carlos Matos, was smoking a cigarette and texting his wife, who was being fitted with an ankle monitoring bracelet. Matos served prison time for bribing Atlantic City council people, but he was never charged in this case. I told him what Witzleben, the federal government lawyer, had just told me.
She said the prosecution was not motivated by the Tartaglione name. It wasn't motivated by the Tartaglione's political connections. It was motivated by her greed and by her theft and by the conspiracy that she oversaw. What's your response?
She's full of shit.
Tartaglione's lawyer said her mother is elderly and battling cancer and could get worse if her daughter was put away, but the pleas for mercy only went so far. Prosecutors asked for close to 15 years, and the judge handed down nearly 7. Matos says the fight isn't over.
I truly still believe in the justice system, and I believe that an appeal will get us out of this mess.
Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Town-gown relations can be tough for any college, and it's harder still when that school is growing and changing the fabric of the surrounding neighborhoods. At Drexel University in Philadelphia, a massive development plan has neighbors especially anxious. Keystone Crossroads contributor Jim Saxa offers this story about the debate around one of the biggest university expansions in Pennsylvania.
As dusk descends over this leafy, middle-class corner of West Philadelphia, a small crowd of neighbors gather at an outdoor potluck. The diverse group of retirees and young parents trade gossip and grilling tips until Blaise Tabia stands up on a park bench.
Everybody who's here who is not a member of the Paladin Village Civic Association is deputized as one tonight. You're welcome to participate in the vote.
This is the June meeting of the Paladin Village Civic Association, and Tabia is the outgoing president. During his time with the group, the neighborhood has changed dramatically. There's been a flood of development and a rash of new student apartments. Most of the blame gets attributed to nearby Drexel University, where the student population has more than doubled in the last 20 years.
Paladin Village's relationship with Drexel has been problematic over at least the past 50 years or so.
And now this tension is growing, as the university is working with developers to cultivate a massive new tech-focused business district, a kind of Silicon Valley on the Schuylkill. If all goes according to plan, this could bring at least 10 new skyscrapers to the area and double the number of jobs. Tabia likes that the city's thriving, but
our neighbors, my neighbors, would like this neighborhood to stay the way it is as much as possible.
This is not a new debate in West Philadelphia. About 20 years ago, a similar dynamic played out a few blocks away in the neighborhoods next to the University of Pennsylvania. As part of a renewal plan, Penn boosted public safety, supported local schools, encouraged staff to buy homes nearby, and patronized local businesses. And it worked. Property values in the neighborhood more than doubled, but the African American population dropped in half, and critics called it gentrification.
You know, I sincerely hope that it's not the future of this neighborhood.
Tobia has good reason to worry that Drexel will follow in Penn's footsteps. John Fry, now Drexel's president, led Penn's redevelopment effort, and he says his overall strategy remains the same.
a lot of that is absolutely the same. And I think that worked well at Penn, and I think we've been able to refine it and tailor it so that it works well at Drexel in a different set of neighborhoods.
But despite similar policies and a much larger development plan, Fry says things will be different this time around.
Well, I think these are very different neighborhoods. I think if you take a look at the Spruce Hill neighborhood, which is immediately west of Penn, its configuration is very different.
But the prospect of thousands of new white-collar jobs close by is already driving up property values near Drexel. And that includes not just Tobias' middle-class neighborhood, but a few very poor ones as well. So the question becomes, what can be done to ensure that the people in those neighborhoods benefit from the development boom? James Wright is a leader at the People's Emergency Center, a nearby nonprofit that supports vulnerable West Philly residents.
And so the idea isn't to just keep it what it is, but the idea is that as things increase, that the people that are here now will not feel a sense of displacement socially and physically.
The trick is how to do that. Cities across the country have been grappling with this question, and there's no silver bullet answer. Like most cities, Philadelphia doesn't have a strategic plan for managing growth. So instead, it falls to community groups to fight for themselves. Near Drexel, a few neighborhood organizations negotiated a community benefits agreement with Drexel's largest development partner, Brandywine Realty Trust. It gives about $3 million over 5 years to help maintain the area's affordability. Is it enough? Again, James Wright.
Absolutely not. Nowhere near enough.
Wright says Brandywine should provide more to help residents deal with the expected rent hikes and property tax increases. But he recognizes the developer's perspective, too.
They say, well, we shouldn't be the ones to try to bear the whole burden for preserving this community because they're not the only developer in the space. And that's very true.
These sort of nuanced positions are not uncommon in this situation. As much as some neighbors may fear new development, they recognize the potential good in it, and they don't really want to block it. And even if they are worried about the neighborhood becoming too expensive, they've been reluctant to do things that would help stop that from happening. For example, the community groups have made it harder to build the kind of dense apartment complexes that can help keep real estate prices down. That's because the real worry for residents is that of change itself. People who wonder, 10 years from now, if their neighborhood will still feel like home. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Jim Saxa.
Teachers from around the world are in Philadelphia through tomorrow for a summit hosted by Penn professor Angela Duckworth. Duckworth has become a superstar in education circles and earned a MacArthur Genius Grant for promoting the idea of character education. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron stopped by her annual conference to hear from the teachers who've adopted her approach.
They came to a hotel conference room in Center City, Philadelphia, from all corners of the globe. Rio, Montreal, New Jersey. And they all had one word on their tongues.
Grit.
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 Grit. Grit.
That's right. Grit.
They tell me you're a man with true grit.
Penn professor Angela Duckworth says grit is a combination of passion and perseverance. She thinks gritty, resilient people are more likely to achieve their goals and lead happy lives. And she thinks these types of character traits can be taught in school by well-trained teachers. Folks like Akeisha Washington, a school counselor from West Philadelphia. A lot of her students have tough, traumatic home lives.
But you gotta have the courage and the strength to say, you know what, I can still feel good about myself, I can still achieve goals, and I know that one day if I work hard enough, I'm gonna get myself out of these situations.
Cesar Volquez teaches middle school math in Newark, New Jersey, and says it takes gumption to get through a tough lesson.
The students are going to make a lot of mistakes, the teachers are going to make mistakes, but if you have the grit to keep going and continue and keep trying, eventually you'll be successful.
Volquez and Washington are at Duckworth's Education Summit to learn how they can instill those values in their students. While those gathered here are believers, some researchers think the importance of grit is overstated, and others don't think it's the type of thing you can teach or measure. But as a full hotel ballroom will attest, this idea and others like it have clearly caught fire in the education world. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
With drug overdose deaths showing no signs of slowing, prosecutors are charging drug dealers as one way to try to stem the tide of addiction. The evidence of whether this works is not settled, But for families who've lost someone, charging a dealer can bring some measure of justice. Transforming Health, Brett Schultes has one family's story.
Strike through.
Darren, way to work. Come back.
When it comes to Little League Baseball, 12-year-old Jaron Myers loves to talk about pitching and his approach on the mound.
I like to throw fast, but not too fast that it goes out of control, but I like to hit my spots. So, like, where the catcher puts his mitt or where, like, whatever he tells me to throw, I like to do that. I like to stay calm and try to slow the game down, not speed it up too fast.
His father, Ryan Myers, was a pitcher in high school and taught Jaron a few things.
He was definitely, like, the main one that helped me with pitching, and like we did a lot of drills. We went up to the field
like many boys. He and his dad bonded over sports. Jaron smiles as he remembers when his father took him to his first NFL football game when he was 10 years old.
Like, I really liked the Ravens, and like I like Baltimore teams, so we went to a football game and it was like a lot of fun.
But when it comes to what happened later that night at home, he struggles to find the right words.
Then I had, then I found out that he had overdosed.
How'd you find out?
Well, at first I didn't, like, know what was happening. Well, I kind of did. But, I heard, like, noises, and so I just went to look, and I just saw.
He found his dad in the bathroom with a needle in his arm. His father, who was 30 years old, died in the hospital 2 days later. When police wanted to know where Ryan had bought the fatal dose of heroin, it was Jaron who helped them.
So I knew, like, where we went and, like, exactly where we went and saw a few people, so I knew how to help out.
18-year-old Kevin Cruz Cuevas of York was arrested and later found guilty of drug delivery resulting in death. It's a charge that had been unheard of until the opioid crisis hit hard in the region, according to Pennsylvania District Attorney Association President John Adams.
Very tragic, and finally dawned on us that we need to use this statute as a tool in our toolbox to combat the drug dealers who are distributing the dangerous drugs that cause death.
Adams says the case is part of a growing push to charge dealers when they kill someone. That has led to more than 412 such charges filed in the Commonwealth since 2013. But not everyone agrees with this approach. Lindsay LaSalle is an attorney with Drug Policy Alliance, a nonprofit fighting the law enforcement trend.
So there is not a shred of evidence that drug-induced homicide charges reduce drug sales, reduce drug use, or reduce drug overdoses.
LaSalle says it's a good thing more people now understand that drug users aren't bad people and often become hooked almost by accident. But she says there's a disconnect between society's sympathy for users and the way that they look at drug sellers.
Right, and I think that it plays out along racialized lines. And now we see this kind of flip where you have the compassion for the person who used, but you want to throw the hammer at the person who sold. And this is just like an absolutely false dichotomy.
Adams says charging dealers is a useful investigative tool. It also gives families justice.
I'm going to say that I hope that there's some deterrent effect out there. I'm not quite certain that I can measure that deterrent effect. But we need to do what we can to bring some justice to those families.
Cruz Cuevas couldn't be reached for a recorded interview per York County prison policy. His attorney didn't respond to requests for comment. Jaron's mother, Suzanne Yorty, knew Ryan Myers since they were in high school. Sitting at a picnic bench at the local pool, she remembers Ryan as an outgoing teenager who excelled in school and sports. That is, until he had surgery for a shoulder injury.
And he was prescribed painkillers for his surgery, and that kind of just started a whole other situation, which obviously led to worse things.
It all started with that prescription.
Oxycontin. Yep. Oxycontin. And he actually, if I remember correctly, went through his prescription in about a week and a half. And he went back to the doctor and they gave him more.
Yorty says nothing will bring Ryan back, including pressing charges against the dealer. But for her, the process has helped her son to take some control of the situation.
You know, I prepared him that Ryan wasn't awake. He can't hear you. He's breathing, but the machine is breathing for him. He has a tube in his mouth. That was when he had his breakdown. But then it wasn't until 2 days later that he told me what he said. And that's when he was like, do you know what I told him? And I said, what? And he was like, I told him that I'm going to get the bad guy. So that was very important to carry that out.
Sitting at the picnic table on a sunny summer day, Jaron looks down as he contemplates what his father might think about everything he's been through and everything he's done to help.
I don't know. I think he would be pretty proud.
Yorty knows her son will continue to deal with his loss as he matures. She says the Little League community, his coaches, as well as Jaron's school have all rallied around them to help. It's one more way that communities are trying to heal the wounds of opioid addiction. In West Manchester Township, York County, I'm Brett Schultes.
Girard College, the historic boarding school in North Philadelphia providing a free education for disadvantaged children from single-parent homes, will be led by a new president starting August 1st. Joining me in conversation is its leader-to-be, Dr. Heather Wathington. Dr. Wathington, thanks so much for joining Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I won't say welcome to Philadelphia, because among your degrees, you got a master's at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes, yes. So this is coming back to Philly for sure.
Your focus is so inordinately on helping students who've been traditionally underserved. You are at a ground zero at Girard. There are some, 300 students there now?
That's correct. We have about 300 students.
Certainly down from its heyday.
Yes, yes.
What would you describe as an optimal student population? And is there work to grow it?
I believe there is work. I think there's a real opportunity for us to grow enrollment and bring sort of more students in need of a Girard education to Girard College.
Its storied history obviously goes all the way back to Stephen Girard, 1848. A fascinating legacy since then, and most recently it had to emerge from more troubled financial straits.
Yes.
What is its condition now in that regard?
I think we're sort of out of what was a period of retrenchment and really moving forward to trying to think through new opportunities, different things that we can do for our students, different things that we can do for Girard, and sort of moving the college forward.
So resources strong, board and staff in place. Mm-hmm. With that, what are some of your short-term goals while you're continuing to learn?
We're definitely in the process of doing some additional strategic planning, right, and setting out longer-term goals. We want to attract more students, so we'll be doing quite a bit of work, I think, about sort of rethinking our academics and our residential education.
To what extent does Girard College have discretion in that residential student status?
We are committed to being residential, so I think there's the residential piece is here to stay.
This school is the envy of almost every other one, to the extent that virtually every student goes on to college.
Indeed, 100% of our students go on to college, which is fabulous.
You've spoken in the past about the need to make students nimble in terms of being flexible thinkers. Mm-hmm. What are some of the keys to that?
Wow. So I think part of a 21st century education has to be helping students think about more than content, more than knowledge, really be able to analyze, synthesize, how could you handle this? What things would you need to be able to do something different? And really be able to be creative. I think what also is really important is helping to build students to create value wherever they are. If you're a gardener, if you're an astronaut, if you're an architect, you can create value wherever you are and be a highly productive citizen and make a difference in the space that you're in.
Flexibility, value, those are life skills above and beyond student skills, but it's still in the context, I presume, of getting students ready to succeed in the application process to then go on to a college.
Sure, sure. So there are definitely important events. And I think colleges use that criteria for a reason. There's underlying constructs that they're looking for that a simple, you know, A in a class tells you, right? But yes, I do think it's really important to be able to help with decision making and help with judgment and building life skills that will enable them to, that won't necessarily show up on a college application, but will enable them to be successful in college or career or anything they choose to do.
When do fall classes get underway?
Fall classes get underway right after Labor Day.
But I thought the board that brought you in holds you in high esteem. Why are they making you start August 1st?
Oh, because there's a lot to do to plan for 18-19. So, and I think, you know, the staff has already been busy planning and getting things ready for our students. But I want an opportunity to just be ready to welcome staff and students when we get started on the 5th.
Well, in that context, I'm grateful for you stopping by and making time for us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Heather Wathington on NewsWorks Tonight. The Philadelphia Art Museum has embarked on its summer children's program called Art Splash. The daily drop-in activity sessions encourage young children to create items inspired by the modernist art currently on exhibition. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the kids have things to teach the adults.
During the summer months, the normally hushed atmosphere inside the Philadelphia Museum of Art turns to this. For the next 10 weeks, the second floor east balcony of the museum has been built into a cardboard cityscape used daily for children's art projects. Art Splash started 6 years ago, and the curator of education, Emily Schreiner, says it has far exceeded expectations.
We thought maybe 10,000 people would come over the 10-week season, and about 27,000 came that first summer, and we've watched it grow and grow. Last year was, I think, about 43,000 people came in that 10-week season.
The kids are making things inspired by the current exhibition, Modern Times, which traces the rise of modernism. And just as the kids are responding to the exhibition is responding to the kids. Quotes by young people are included in the wall text next to the artwork in the gallery. Modern Times curator is Jessica Todd Smith, and she is taking notes.
One of my favorites is by a child who makes the observation that everybody thinks that they're modern. Who doesn't think that they're modern, right? As an art historian, I'm used to historicizing things and putting them in historical context, but this child had this idea that the modern moment is whatever moment you're in.
Some of the children were quite blunt about their distaste for modern art. One stood in front of Marcel Duchamp's cubist masterpiece, Nude Descending a Staircase, and said, quote, "I don't know what it is, but I'm bad at solving cubism." Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.